6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. No power frequency radio modulation.
And good afternoon. Welcome to A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. Joining us here in the studio is Ruth Conniff, a political commentator, columnist for the Progressive magazine locally, but is also appears all over the left progressive spectrum of various periodicals. She's been on MSNBC with Ed Schultz and others, and has become an important asset, really, to the WRT listening area. Her commentaries appear regularly on the Progressive website and elsewhere. And last time we had you on, Ruth, people had a lot of positive comment and feedback. So I hope today you can come in with your positive feedback and comments. And
I should have quit while I was ahead, Alan. I'm going to ruin it.
Yeah, I don't think so, Ruth.
Torpedo my award listenership support here.
No, I just don't run for the school board. You've been writing, a number of columns recently. You watch what's been going on at the State House quite closely. Let's start with Walker. never mind. Governor Walker's assault on the poor. That is the recent things, this mandatory job training for food stamps. And then on top of that, heaped on the state refusal of $65 million to expand Medicaid coverage in the state. Let's start with that. What is that about? It on its face, it makes no sense whatsoever. Even I don't know what the conservative thinking is.
I think the conservative thinking is if you want to run for president in the Republican Party, you need to get tough on the poor and tough on the idea that government can do anything for people. And so Walker is sort of grandstanding by turning away this federal Medicaid money. But it's going to have a very profound effect. Tens of thousands of Wisconsinites who depend on Badger Care will not have health insurance anymore. And, of course, as you remember, he announced this not in his budget address. He announced it to Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce when they were gathered at Monona Terrace. And both the Work for Food initiative and the helpful advice that the governor offered that the poor can become more independent and self-reliant if they don't have health care. That was his announcement to that group, and he got a big round of applause from business leaders in Wisconsin for those initiatives, which are part of his budget.
Well, he certainly knows where his bread is buttered, literally and figuratively.
I mean, it's going to not only are people not going to have health care, it's going to cost jobs. We're going to lose thousands of jobs. People who provide health care are going to lose jobs because we won't take free federal money. It's a pretty dire initiative.
And that comes, of course, in tandem with this mandatory job training. They talk, job, that trope of jobs. I keep on thinking, yes, they're doing a job.
Yeah, I mean, never mind that we are dead last in the Midwest for job creation in Wisconsin. I mean, we have lagged the national recovery, which is about to get a major hit tomorrow with this austerity bomb. But to the extent that there has been a modest recovery nationwide, Wisconsin has not been a part of it, thanks to Walker's policies in large part. And yet here he is talking about job training. Where are the jobs that we're training for? And not only that, but as you know, he made a 10% cut to higher ed, and he focused very specifically on technical colleges, and even within those technical colleges, particularly on programs like a program in Milwaukee to train electricians that focused on rebuilding the African-American working class, giving people real-world job skills. He cut those programs. He has done an abysmal job of maintaining jobs in the state of Wisconsin. There was just a piece in the Cap Times, I think it was either Cap Times or the State Journal, about how people, we are now, according to some moving van line, we rank in the top 10 of states that people are getting the hell out of because there's nowhere to work here. Right. So forcing people to work in order to get their food stamps is unlikely to make a big dent in that situation.
Right, these stories of people migrating, commuting from Wisconsin to North Dakota for the jobs in the booming fracking industry out there. 256-2001. Our guest today is Ruth Conniff from the Progressive magazine, political commentator. 256. Give us a call on this, a pledge drive edition of A Public Affair. By the way, we have, for those of you who call and pledge this hour at the $50 level, there are subscriptions to the Progressive Magazine, so you can read folks like Ruth Conniff and Matt Rothschild and lots of other folks. One of my favorites being Will Durst, who was on a couple of weeks ago, 256-2001. You know, when I saw this story, Ruth Conniff, about the mandatory job training for food stamps, I thought to myself, what, everyone who gets food stamps in this state can work? It has the potential to work? What about the disabled, the elderly, the kids? And it's so callous.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's bad. And I think what makes it worse, obviously, is that the jobs themselves are not. I mean, you can train yourself as hard as you can, but if there's not a job for you, you know, forget it. And also, a lot of people who get food stamps are employed. They have jobs. You know, there are a lot of people who are living below the poverty line who are relying not just on food stamps, but on food banks because they're not making enough money to keep their family fed.
256-2001. You use that term I like very much, and I will steal from you now, the austerity bomb.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Well, tomorrow's a big day. We've all been hearing a lot about it. You know, tomorrow's the day these automatic cuts go into effect, the sequester. And there's a lot of finger-pointing going on in Washington about whose fault it is, but there's not a whole lot of effort to prevent it from happening. And this is, you know, this is the grand game of chicken that the Obama administration and the Republicans in Congress agreed to play. And they basically said, we're going to make random across-the-board cuts, heavy-duty cuts to defense, which the Republicans don't like, and a lot of cuts to domestic spending that hit real people who are, you know, supposed to be represented by the Democrats. So the idea behind this great notion was that it was so lousy that because of this concocted crisis, our political leaders would be forced to strike some kind of a deal to deal with the budget deficit. So there are so many things wrong with this. A, it didn't work. We're about to actually drive off that cliff in this game of chicken. We are heading for it. So it didn't actually force a deal. But secondly, the whole focus on the deficit is a priority, that it is so important to cut the deficit during a recession when deficit spending has been historically proven to help spur economic growth to get us out of the recession and ultimately to reduce the deficit itself. You know, it's just so wrongheaded. And it is an unnecessary crisis. It is going to be very hard. It's going to be very hard on states like Wisconsin that are going to lose a lot of funding for programs that just keep people going. And you know, it's a big disaster. And frankly, you know, I wrote a piece on the Progressive website on Tuesday about the fact that it is Jacob Lew, Obama's choice for Treasury Secretary, who has just been confirmed. And as he was being confirmed and the deficit bomb was about to hit us, you know, Bob Woodward has written this book. There's been a whole controversy about Bob Woodward lately about whether or not the White House was really mean to him or not. But setting that aside,
I have my own take on Bob Woodward.
I've assumed
he's always been a spook.
Yeah. Nonetheless, he has this very compelling anecdote in his book, and I think it's really important for people to understand that it was Jacob Lew, our new Treasury Secretary, who came up with the idea for the sequester, for this austerity bomb, proposed it to Harry Reid, who, according to Woodward, ducked over and put his head between his knees like he was going to be sick because it was such a dangerous notion. In fact, it's turned out to be just as dangerous as Harry Reid feared. And then the thing that I wrote about on Tuesday is not only did Harry Reid get, you know, kicked in the gut with this idea for the sequester, then when it moved forward and they began these rounds of negotiations to keep us from going off the fiscal cliff, you remember Obama ostensibly won the first round on New Year's Day when the Republicans agreed to increase taxes on the very wealthy. But Harry Reid, according to a really long and interesting piece by National Journal, was actually holding out for a better deal. And the Obama administration sent Joe Biden in, made an end run around Harry Reid, agreed to redefine the middle class as people not who make less than $250,000 a year, but people who make less than $400,000, or if you're a married couple, $450,000 a year. That's a middle class person, somebody who makes less than $450,000 a year. Are you kidding me? So they got a deal that was really not anything to crow about. It's true. People who make stratospheric incomes are going to pay a little more in taxes. But people who make between $250 and $400, they are locked into the Bush era tax break. So the top 1%, not the top 2%, are defined as the rich. Everybody else is the middle class. So they got this deal. It was okay. It was considered a big deal that Obama could get the rich to pay more taxes at all, could get the Republicans to agree to that. But then they kicked the can down the road on all of the spending issues. And so as Tom Harkin points out, there's no bargaining chips. You know, the Republicans have said, we gave you your tax increase. Now it's nothing but cuts. It's nothing but cuts to spending. So here we are now in this lousy negotiating situation with this Wall Street friendly administration and Treasury Secretary. And it's really, it's an outrage for ordinary citizens that the Republicans on the Senate Finance Committee, when they were approving Jacob Lew, had to be the ones to point out that he earned over $900,000 in a cash bonus the day before Citigroup, where he was working, got its taxpayer-funded bailout, that he has, you know, offshore investments in the Cayman Islands. This is pure politics for the Republicans, but it's still true. And it, you know, it just really goes to how do we as ordinary citizens get our interests represented and keep them from liquidating our society?
I noticed, Ruth Conniff, that there was this kind of grandstanding by Governor Walker in relation to all this.
Oh, the sequester. Yes, he's all for it. Let's go off the cliff. Let's, you know, I mean, the idea that it's really, it's healthy and it's good for us to destroy government is, of course, a bedrock right-wing belief. I mean, it goes back to Grover Norquist and the idea that we need to get government down to the size where we can drown it in the bathtub. And this is, you know, this is a step towards that.
We already have a caller with a comment or question. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Yeah, Ruth is pretty well laid out how the Wisconsin state government's firmly in the hands of the Republican right wing. And 2 years after the uprising, you know, unions are a lot weaker and all this damage is being wreaked. And at the national level, although the Obama and the National Democrats aren't quite as extreme as the Republicans, I mean, they're going to come together, as Ruth has laid out, to, you know, impose even worse austerity. And so my question is, isn't it time to switch off of the strategy of that so many progressive organizations and movements have had of trying to elect, you know, lesser evil Democrats, you know, trying to elect, you know, some liberals and progressives, the national and state, you know, legislatures, and to figure out a way to build a movement at the grassroots, which, you know, can educate and mobilize people in direct action as things get worse and spiral down, you know, to put pressure on the corporate ruling class.
Thank you,
you
caller.
Know, in the workplaces.
Thank you, caller. We got the we got the lengthy question.
Well, I agree. Yeah, I agree. And I think that it is. I think it is absolutely critical that we build a genuine grassroots movement that is not just part of the corporate Democratic Party. And of course, it's something that we talk about all the time, but how does it actually happen? And I guess I would just try to narrow the focus, because I think we can get overwhelmed when we think about the magnitude of the problems that we face. And so one small example, I think, here in Wisconsin, a very hot issue right now is education in schools. And we are looking in Madison at possibly having voucher schools. And that is, you know, our school board just voted unanimously to oppose that. It is really important that we focus on this issue. And I think one thing that can be done and is being done is for communities around the state to get together and do some education about the issue of saving our public schools, which have been excellent in the state of Wisconsin. And we really are at a tipping point about whether we're going to go forward and have excellent public schools or whether we're going to liquidate them.
You know, I found it just fantastic, because, and it was foreshadowed 2 years ago, that the push for the expansion of various levels, and we can talk about that momentarily, but the expansion at various levels of the voucher school program and charter schools, and this creation of this charter authorization panel appointed by the governor, which will bypass local school districts and the State Department of Public Instruction in its authority to charter schools, that it comes in the budgetary process.
Right.
It bypasses. These bills were did not fly last year, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, and now they're re-injected through the budgetary process. This really this subversion of democracy, of the electoral process, of parliamentary democracy.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's really clear that the reason for that is that this is an issue where Republican legislators felt tremendous pressure from their own constituents, because rural areas of Wisconsin that elect Republicans and have one little school that has a football team and puts on an annual musical and is the center of their community, that is threatened by this statewide charter authorizing board that actually is the brainchild of a corporation called K-12, which is an online education company, and the chair of the ALEC Committee on Education. This is the origin of this idea, this bad idea that came up, was defeated, and now is in Walker's budget. So voters understood that what it meant was money siphoned out of the public schools and into online education, which meant my little school in my little town will close down. And the same is true with vouchers. You know, in Racine, people are not happy that half of the money in their voucher system, which Walker expanded to Racine from Milwaukee, went to parents who already had their children in private school. Your public money is now going not so that somebody who's in a lousy public school can get a break and go to a private school. No, it's going to parents who could afford to send their kids to private school and now get your tax dollars to supplement the tuition.
Right. They raised the income cap.
Yes.
Up to what? $69,000.
Yes.
Anyone earning $69,000, a family of four or less, could possibly be eligible to this voucher system, which means, for those of you who haven't been following this, that there's an allotment, I think it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $7,000 per student, that will be taken from the public school coffers, from school districts, and go directly to private, either online or brick-and-mortar voucher schools and charter schools.
And what people need to know is that the state portion of that money comes off the top of the entire budget. It comes before we pay for anything else in education out of state funds, we pay for those vouchers. And in Racine, it's not just perspective. It's not like maybe rich people will take advantage of this. It is a fact that half of the money they put into their voucher system went to people who had already put their kids in private school, which is not what anybody views as some kind of social justice act, right?
Right. Ruth, you're on the left progressive spectrum in the media and so on. You work at the progressive. You write for, various left and progressive blog sites. Talk a little bit about the importance of alternative media.
Well, I mean, it's critical. I mean, without the reporting and the on-the-ground view of community radio stations, we just wouldn't get news about things that are critical to us. We wouldn't know what's going on in our community. And especially with the increasing corporate concentration of big media outlets, it is so rare that you get that voice. And I think in Wisconsin we see this because we see the right-wing infiltration with Wisconsin Reporter into state capitol coverage. You know, the right is doing something really smart. They're setting up quote unquote reporters with from right wing foundations in state capitals to make up for the fact that regular daily newspapers no longer have anybody watching these hearings. They no longer have anybody telling you what's going on in state government. You know, Alan, our mutual friend Rebecca Campbell covers the capitol for us. Sole reporter in the state of Wisconsin who is going there and tracking what's happening as we shift public money into these private entities.
You know, she uploaded some photos of one of these hearings just yesterday in which these Republicans are leaning back in their chairs with their hands behind their heads, leaning back, relaxing. The only thing that was missing was the diamond stick pin in their vests and the cigar smoke. They're not puffing on cigars because they no longer can. But it's really, you know, the thing that I talked about quite often at the time of these the so-called uprising was the fact that at the broader historical level, what was going on with the Walker folks was the dismantling of the Wisconsin idea. That notion that the two ends of State Street, the University of Wisconsin and the Capitol, would work together for the benefit of the people of the state. Talk about what's happening at the other end of State Street a little bit, the attack on higher education.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting because higher education obviously is a huge point of pride in the state of Wisconsin. And one of the reasons cited in this article I was talking about people leaving the state of Wisconsin is that their kids can't go to UW, you know, can't afford it, are being priced out. And that this effort to dismantle, to sever the flagship Wisconsin campus from all the campuses around the state, which is truly the Wisconsin idea and a progressive innovation that has led not just to great education and not just opportunities for people to go to college all over the state, but also to the development through the ag wing of the university of innovations in agriculture. It's what made us the dairy state. It's what has created economic growth in the state of Wisconsin. And it's ironic, of course, that the Walker administration, which claims that it's all about jobs, is waging this assault, both a budgetary assault and a structural readjustment of our university system to really kill that engine of economic growth and opportunity for people.
We have a couple callers waiting to get on with a question or comment for our guest today, Ruth Conniff. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello.
Please.
I guess my comment, I'm kind of following on the lines of the first caller, but a concern that I've developed over the years is that publications like the Progressive are fine publications, and they do a good job of stating what the problem is. But essentially, that's all they do is talk. And I would make the same judgment about an individual like John Nichols. He's a skilled orator, but again, all he does is talk. What he says is correct, but he fails to provide any way of going from here to there. And I think part of that fact is due to the reality that the Progressive is a magazine that primarily has an upper middle class readership who already have some vested interest in the maintaining of the status quo. I realize that what I've said is extremely controversial, and I'd be interested in hearing what observations you might have on those points of view, and thanks for taking the call.
Well, you know what? I am really interested in what we do to save our butts in the state of Wisconsin. And, you know, I am part of this community. And so
Born and raised in Madison.
I was born and raised in Madison. I have three children in the Madison Public Schools. This is really, really, I have skin in this game. So, you know, I think it's really important that we figure this thing out. And actually, I wrote a column about this in Isthmus a couple weeks ago, and I talked to Frank Emspeck. I actually stopped my car, pulled over to the side of the road, and started taking a lot of notes on what he was saying, because this is exactly the problem that we face. And I think it's something that, as Wisconsinites, we are really overwhelmed by the feeling that we had this incredible showing in these massive historic protests against Walker, and yet we had our butts handed to us, and we are looking, you know, we're really staring down the barrel of a brutal right-wing takeover of our state. And how do we even begin to fight against this stuff? And I think, you know, we really have to focus our energies on specific areas where we think we can make a difference. And I do think that beating back some of these education initiatives is one of those places, because I think what we have to do is we cannot just talk to ourselves in our own little circles and congratulate ourselves about being so PC. We have to reach out and make coalitions with people. You know, on the education front, speaking of controversial, I have to direct listeners to the Madison Times editorial about Sarah Mansky dropping out of the school board race and about the tremendous feeling of racial antagonism in the schools in Madison, and the fact that we have got to make common cause. We have got to stop talking past each other. I think that's a place where we really need to focus our energies right now. You know, this whole issue of how are we going to survive? How are our kids going to do well in this economy? How are we going to, you know, be able to have good jobs and health care? I mean, this stuff is not esoteric. And I agree with the caller that we can't just talk to ourselves.
You know, it's interesting. Related, you know, you know, related there is, you know, there's been an immense conversation, sometimes civil, sometimes very animated, around closing the achievement gap in the Madison schools. And no one denies that there is an achievement gap. It's a matter of how to get there. With this further gutting of the public education system through vouchers and charters, draining those coffers, at some level, that achievement gap has to worsen. And people are still haven't seen that. It's not on a lot of folks' horizons yet, or a radar, that, you know, further cripple public education, and what happens? The disparities have to increase.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that when Walker talks about how he's going to reward schools that are doing well and penalize schools that are not doing well, what he's really talking about is targeting money to schools in affluent communities where the kids score well on tests, so they're going to get even more money. And the schools where they're dealing with special needs and all kinds of struggles that, you know, require a lot more support, they're going to have even less to work with. I mean, that's just such a fundamental injustice. I think here in Madison, though, we really we are confronted with a very interesting problem, and it is the gap in sort of the cultural understanding of what these issues mean and what is going on. And historically in Wisconsin, you know, we had the first voucher program in Milwaukee, and it is absolutely the case that it was funded by right-wing foundations. The Bradley Foundation was big behind it, and that it put African-American parents out front, and people like Polly Williams, who was a Democratic legislator, African-American here in Wisconsin, co-wrote the voucher legislation initially with Tommy Thompson and said, you know, this is an opportunity for black kids who are underserved in their schools to get a chance. And so, oddly, right-wing Republicans became the champions of civil rights who really wanted to do something, and unions and teachers were portrayed as the enemy of education for poor black kids. But the thing is, there is reality to the anger felt by these black parents.
Totally legitimate.
And so when you get a school board candidate like Sarah Mansky, who runs for office and then drops out because her husband, you know, got into an educational program and a PhD program in California and just kind of leaves, you see something like this Madison Times editorial today, and how that is perceived in the black community in Madison is that this is a white gloves, liberal white lady who ran for school board as her backup plan and is now leaving town because she has better things to do. She'd be horrified by that, right? I mean, Sarah Mansky considers herself, she describes herself as an American revolutionary. She's a progressive. But there's a big problem in our community that white folks who are talking about defending the unions and defending public education are perceived as the enemy of shaking things up and doing something for black parents and their kids who are suffering from the achievement gap. And we really have something to talk about here. I mean, I think we have to figure out how to talk to each other and make common cause, because it can be done. I mean, we should be able to get on the same side, but we have a real problem of perception and of being able to listen, I think, in Madison. I think black kids and their parents have the experience of feeling that they are not listened to, and we've got to start doing something about this.
I find it very interesting that white right-wingers in this community who have, you know, are suddenly the allies. Their primary motivation, as I can read it, is privatization and the market works, and get government off out of everything, and suddenly they're championing, you know, and of course, give them any opportunity whatsoever to attack liberals, progressives, the left, and so on, and they go ballistic. So it's a very strange coalition of a stew. You know, some people have the legitimate right to stew, you know, to be ticked off. But again, there's opportunism all over the place.
Okay, but here's what I'm saying. I mean, yes, there have been a couple of right-wing columns really blasting Mansky and basically, you know, taking this position because they love to blast liberals. On the other hand, there is this editorial in the Madison Times. You got to read it. It's about the school board race highlights the discontent between the two Madisons. And really, it's about something very real. And I think we have to understand that, you know, you and I, Alan, we know the whole network, and it's only a handful of right-wing foundations that are funding the privatization of education all over this country. And they've come in big to Wisconsin, and they're a major funder of Republicans at the state level. We know that. We know their names. We know it's the DeVos family based in Michigan, who, you know, of Amway, the Amway fortune. We know this whole map, right? But when we talk to parents on the South Side about it, we might as well be talking about the threat of UFOs landing in our backyard, right? I mean, this is not their issue. And I think, you know, we have to figure out, how do we talk about really doing something for people who are really frustrated and being serious about it? And the problem with the voucher solution, the problem with the, you know, the individual independent charter solution, and I really make a distinction between independent charters that have no standards and get to just, you know, suck up money and not prove that they're doing anything, which is what Walker wants, and charters like Nuestro Mundo, which are governed by the school board here in Madison. The problem with the solution with the vouchers and the independent charters is that even if there are some good ones, it is a solution for a small number of people. And the question that we're really facing is whether, as a society, we can serve all our kids. We can have this incredibly optimistic idea called the public school system, where we believe that we can provide a high-quality free public education to all our kids. And we have, like, that's really in the balance in Wisconsin right now. And somehow we got to pull for it, and we have to listen to the people who are not being served by the existing situation, even as we're so defensive because that the whole thing is threatened now, right?
Right. Let's get a caller. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. Three things. Mary Burke bought her seat on the school board. Second, how do we get a letter-writing campaign to tell Obama to fire Arnie Duncan? And third, the $40,000 that Scott Walker used, that moved over to his criminal defense fund. Where is that? What's happening with that? Thank you, and I look forward to your response, and thank you for this show.
Thank you. What is happening with that whole...
Yeah, why does he keep putting money in that criminal defense fund?
And why isn't his tush in jail?
I know. And why does Cullen Worley always say, no, there's absolutely nothing to worry about, and then they transfer another few tens of thousands of dollars into the criminal defense fund? I mean, obviously, there's something there. There's enough there that they're concerned, and they're going to lawyer up and get ready. But nothing big has broken, and I don't have anything really exciting to report on that front.
Let us continue with the phones, because, again, I want to get this last caller in today, and I want to get to another crucial topic, I think. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
I wanted to talk about the McKenzie Center, the Environmental Education Center in Poinette, which the Walker administration wants to turn into a hunting haven. He wants to deregulate the carnival game industry, I guess you could call it. These are such obvious, acceptance of bribes for proposed legislation. But mainly, I think the only function of government is to govern, that is to regulate and to tax to support that regulation. And since so many of our public officials are getting themselves elected and then proceed to destroy the institution they were elected to. I don't have a copy of the Wisconsin Constitution in front of me, but it seems to me they're breaking the law by being Trojan horses instead of doing everything possible to ensure that we live in a fair society. And so I think there should be a very specific part of the oath of office when they assume it, that if they don't, I don't know how it could be worded, but they have to fight for the continuation of this society, democratic society.
Thank you, Colin. Ruth's kind of...
Sure, I'm for that.
Yeah, right. This thing about the functions of government, one of the standard definitions of the state, of government, is that it has the monopoly on violence. And in this sense, what this Republican right-wing offensive is doing is violence to legitimize, in a sense, through the state, violence to hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, there's an interesting story about veterans objecting to the Medal of Honor for people who fly drones being higher in rank than the Purple Heart and the medals for people who, had their limbs blown off in actual combat. I mean, I think we're so anesthetized and distanced from these kinds of violence that it's a weird place to be in.
Ruth Conniff, let's switch gears a little bit. I said I wanted to get to this topic. You wrote a column back in January already, about the fact that it was the 40th anniversary of Roe versus Wade. There's also this massive violence, again, an assault on women at numerous levels being waged at the national and state level, especially in terms of reproductive rights and so on. Talk about that.
Well, I mean, the most recent thing, I wrote that column right after I emceed this 40th anniversary of Roe event for Planned Parenthood in Wisconsin at the Majestic, and it was really an honor to be part of that event. There was a panel of women who just talked about their personal experience and their gratitude to Planned Parenthood, and You know, you really, the way that the panel was organized, it started with somebody who talked about what it was like when birth control was illegal on the UW campus if you weren't married, and people would borrow their friends' wedding rings in order to get birth control, and moved right up through a woman who had a late-term abortion of a baby who was going to be born dead, and how we don't understand what late-term abortion really is and how much harder and more painful and agonizing we make it because you can't get this at a hospital. You can't get it from your own obstetrician. You have to go out of state and, you know, walk through protesters and go to a separate outpatient clinic. And then we talk about, you know, well, people feel guilty and horrible. Well, they're being tortured essentially in order to, you know, get this standard medical care. And then, you know, just with a sense of when we closed with a woman who talked about just how she had raised her daughters, really knowing what Planned Parenthood was. They're still young, but that we have this sense of being, you know, in control of our own bodies. And culturally, we've moved so far on this issue that women really are not going to accept the Paul Ryan, Todd Akin view that, you know, we should be shamed, that we should hold an aspirin between our knees, that we shouldn't have full, happy sex lives and have children when we want to have children and not be, you know, pushed around or humiliated like that. So, you know, it was this very uplifting event. It was great. And then within the next week, Governor Walker cut funds and caused the closure of 4 Planned Parenthood clinics around the state of Wisconsin that provide not abortion, actually, but birth control and cervical cancer screenings to women in the state who aren't going to be able to get that now in their community or even anywhere nearby. So
And then right after that, proclaimed what he called Protect Life Day.
Yeah, that was awful. Well, that was the actual 40th anniversary of Roe. He took language directly from Wisconsin Right to Life and issued a proclamation making the anniversary of Roe v. Wade the statewide Protect Life Day, and, you know, talked about the importance of protecting the unborn, and, you know, really turned it into a pro-life anniversary instead of an anniversary of this landmark decision that really advanced women's rights and freedoms.
We started the hour with you know what? Let's go to the phone. I see Nigel behind the glass there is motioning to me. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Yes. I'm one of the ticked off people that Ruth talked about because of what has happened in Madison since that Madison Prep proposal came forth and the race card was played. And then when this school board seat debacle come up, Darrell Conner planted the seed of conspiracy. David Blaska ran with it, and it's dividing the community even more. When those of us who know and do the research that this whole thing was a scheme for privatization, that Colleen Kerr said at the school board meeting that he would put his own people in because it was voted down. And it's time for people to understand what's really going on, that this achievement gap is the myth that's been being played in order to privatize education, and they're using people of color, as a tool to get this passed because many of them don't understand and don't keep up with what's going on.
I just quickly want to say that I don't think it's a myth. I think that there is a legitimate achievement gap. There are disparities that we can see statistically and through lots of measures, but I do tend to agree with you that there are certain elements, not all, there's people that are rightfully and legitimately concerned, but there are also elements in this community and statewide and nationally that are playing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was Howard Fuller who said, please don't tell me that everything we've been fighting for to give kids who are stranded in schools that are failing them in Milwaukee a chance turns out to be just a Trojan horse so that we can lift the cap for vouchers and make it possible for rich people to get a better bargain on sending their kids to private school. I mean, there's a lot of angst here because the complaint's real, the problems are real, there are a lot of people of goodwill who are, and I mean, I think Kaleem, you know, I think Kaleem is motivated by really actually caring about this stuff. He's also totally willing to take money from the Bradley Foundation and anybody else who wants to give it to him. You know, so, you know, there's a mix of of real problems and real complaints, and then, you know, this huge pot of money that's coming in and manipulating things from outside of our state. And I just think on a very local level, I think that we can get together as a community and try to address the very legitimate complaints that people have, try to come out of our silos and really talk about how we make things work better for kids in our community. And I felt like that Madison Times editorial was a real wake-up call. I really think people should look at that.
You know, very quickly, Ruth Cuddiff, the word silo has moved into our language, that everybody's in their separate silos. And I just wanted to point out that silo technology, as it is applied to agriculture, was an innovation of the Wisconsin idea and the Ag School of the University of Wisconsin.
Oh, Dairy State.
Right?
Woo.
But yeah, we got to get out of our compartmentalized, separate...
I didn't mean to diss silos.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, they're not... Yeah, we certainly don't want missile silos. We're getting toward the end of the hour. I want to, Ruth, let me throw out one more thing that that I know you've looked at closely, and that is the ongoing efforts at voter suppression. The voter ID bills, the theft through gerrymandering, the change in the bases for determining electoral college distribution and votes. Talk about a little bit. We got about 7 minutes left in the hour, but I wanted to get that in.
Well, the Center for Media and Democracy has done a report on this, and really it's Brendan Fisher's work that I wrote about last week. He shows how nationally the Republicans are overtly pursuing a strategy of suppressing the votes of Black people, other people of color, the elderly, and students, because they tend to vote Democratic. And they have a plan by which they hope to take the redistricting that has really kicked us in the ass here in Wisconsin and turn it into electoral college votes that will take blue states like Wisconsin and turn them red so that they can lock down the White House by losing the popular vote and yet winning the presidential election every year. It is so nefarious. It's unbelievable. And then add to that the Supreme Court taking up the fundamental voting rights law right now and looking at saying, you know what, racism is over. And so in states like Alabama, they are going to be able to go ahead and impose the same kind of voter ID laws that we see taking place around the country, including here in Wisconsin. They're going to be able to go ahead and, you know, bring back the literacy test and the poll tax and keep those Black voters away. They're going to, you know, they're really seriously considering at the Supreme Court level getting rid of federal supervision of these historically racist states in the South. And then, you know, my God, you know, what are we looking at?
Yeah, and, you know, you have to think back about in the initial moments right after the election and the swearing in of Barack Obama, that there were, I don't know what they were thinking, but there was people talking about we are now entering an era of post-racial America. I had Ruthie Gilmore, the noted, radical geographer and advocate of prison abolition on and at that time. And she said, yeah, I get it. Post-racial America, we got a brother in the White House and a million in the big house. One last quick caller in, and then we're going to have to head toward wrapping it up. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Ellen, thanks for the show. My question is for your guest is, why has it been that the Democratic Party continues to run away from the labor movement and not bring up collective bargaining and saying we want to reassert collective bargaining as an issue before the public and start talking about it as an issue, even though they're not a minority, but they still have a duty to raise issues publicly to defend the working class and to defend public workers in our state?
Thank you, caller.
Well, I mean, right, this has been a huge disappointment, and I think, you know, it's very obvious why. It's because labor union membership has declined so precipitously that the Republicans can make a race to the bottom argument to non-union working class folks and say, you know, why should those public employees have it so good? Why should they get benefits when you don't have them? And it's working for them, and the Democrats are afraid of picking up that fight because they know that, you know, with the union membership in the single digits, they're not talking to enough people. And really what has to happen is getting more people organized and, you know, really making the case that both the Democratic Party and the labor unions themselves are going to do something about the conditions that private sector workers are facing, which are dire.
Ruth Conniff, I want to thank you very, very much for coming in. I enjoy very much having you on, and I imagine it will happen in the not-too-distant future. I've been your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. Gee, I can't say my name today. My name is Alan Ruff, and I will be talking with you next week. Thanks a lot.
Let's drink to the hardworking people. Let's drink to the lonely of them.